From Zakhar Masoch to Masochism by Gilles Deleuze. Zakhar Masoch, 1835 to 1895, born in Lemberg, Galicia, Spanish and Bohemian heritage. Family of public servants under the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His father was chief of the Lemberg police. The theme of the police would haunt Masoch's work. One of his main sources of inspiration, however, would be the problem of minorities, Jewish, Little Russian, etc. Masoch is part of the great tradition of German Romanticism. He did not see his work as perverse, but as generic and encyclopedic, a vast cycle that was supposed to constitute a natural history of humanity under the overall title, The Legacy of Cain. Of the six planned parts, love, prosperity, money, state, war, death, he finished the first two, yet love, for him, was already inseparable from a cultural, political, social, an ethnological complex. Masoch's taste in love is renowned. Muscle seems to be an essentially feminine material for him. He wanted the woman he loved to have furs and a whip. The loved woman is not at all sadistic by nature, but she is slowly persuaded, trained for her function. He wanted to be bound by her by a contract with precise clauses. One of these clauses often led him to dress as a servant and change his name. His most fervent wish was the intervention of a third person between himself and his lover, and he asked for it. Venus and Furs, his most famous novel, presents a detailed contract. His biographer, Schlichter Groll, and then Kraft Ebbing, produced other examples of Masoch's contracts. In 1869, Kraft Ebbing gave the name masochism to a perversion, to the great displeasure of Masoch himself. As an author, Zakhar Masoch was not an outcast. He was honored, celebrated, and decorated. He was famous in France. Triumphant welcome, Légion d'honneur, Revue des Deux Mondes. At the time of his death, however, he suffered from the obscurity into which his work had fallen. When you give your name to a disturbance or an illness, whether you like it or not, you are not supposed to have invented it. You are supposed, for example, to have isolated the disease, distinguished it from other cases with which it had been confused until now, identified and assembled the symptoms in a new and decisive way. Etiology depends first of all on good symptomatology. Symptomatologic specificity comes first. The specificity of the causing agent is always second and relative. It is therefore regrettable that, in the case of Masoch, the specialists in masochism showed so little interest in the content of his work. In general, they contented themselves with much less precise, much more vague symptomatology than the one found in Masoch's work itself. The so-called unity of sadism and masochism multiplied the confusion. Here and elsewhere, inadequate definitions of the symptoms led to useless and even imprecise etiologies. Comparing the work of Masoch to that of Sade, one is struck by the impossibility of an encounter between a sadist and a masochist. Their environments, their ceremonies, are entirely different. Their requirements are in no way complementary. Sade's inspiration is primarily mechanist and instrumentalist. Masoch's is profoundly culturalist and aesthetic. When the senses have works of art as their object, they feel themselves to be masochist for the first time. Renaissance paintings reveal to Masoch the power of the woman's musculature enveloped in furs. A woman is loved in her resemblance with a statue, and the masochist gives back to art everything it gives to him. In making himself paint or take photos, in surprising his reflection in a mirror, he experiences and knows himself. we learn that the senses become theorists, that the eye becomes a human eye when its object itself has become a human object, coming from humans and destined for humans. An organ becomes human when it takes an art object as its object. Masochism is presented as the suffering of a transmutation. Every animal suffers when its organs stop being animal. Borrowing an expression from Goethe, Masoch's refrain is, "I am ultra-sensualist, and even ultra-sentimental." The second characteristic of masochism, one that is even more opposed to sadism, is the predilection for contracts, the extraordinary contractual appetite. Masochism must be defined by its formal characteristics, not by a supposedly dolorogenic content. And of all the formal characteristics, none is more important than the contract. No masochism without a contract with the woman. However, the essential point is precisely that the contract is projected in the relationship of the man with the dominant woman. Ordinarily, the contract has a function that closely bound to patriarchal societies. It is made for expressing and even justifying what is non-material, spiritual, or established in relationships of authority and association as they are formed between, including between, father and son. The material and chthonic bond that unites us with a woman, however, that united the child to the mother, seems to rebel against contractual expression by nature. When a woman enters into a contract, it is by coming to men, by recognizing her dependence within patriarchal society. In Masoch's contract, everything is reversed. Here, the contract expresses the material predominance of the woman and the superiority of the maternal principle. The masochist intention that defines this reversal, this projection, will be examined, especially since the masochist also transposes the movement through which the contract evolves over time, when it was supposed to be the foundation of virile society. Because every contract, in the precise meaning of this term, requires a temporal limit, the non-intervention of a third party, the exclusion of certain inalienable properties, for example, life, yet there is no society that can preserve itself without postulating its own eternity, without claiming its hold over third parties who have not made a contract, and without giving itself the right to death over its subjects. This movement is rediscovered and accentuated in the masochist contract with the woman. If needed, Masoch's contract provides for a time limit in the absolute, but the woman is free to make this time last by dividing it into sections. A subsidiary and secret clause gives her the right to death, and the place of the third party is reserved through a deft legal precaution. The woman is like an absolute monarch who holds onto and multiplies her rights. The masochist, as her subject, effectively loses all of his. Everything takes place as if Masoch's culturalism was still more legal than aesthetic. Masochism cannot be separated from the contract, but at the same time, it projects it onto the dominant woman. It pushes it to the extreme, dismantling its machinery and maybe ridiculing it. Masoch's contract, thirdly, can only be understood from strange historical perspectives. Masoch often makes reference to a period of beautiful nature, to an archaic world presided over by Venus Aphrodite, where the only law for fugitive relationships between woman and man was pleasure between equal partners. Masoch's heroines do not have a sadistic nature, but they say they have a pagan, antique, and heroic one. However, this beautiful nature was destabilized by a climate disaster or a glacial catastrophe. Natural law then withdrew into the maternal breast, as it did the female principle that retained some heat. Men became children of thought. In their efforts towards an autonomous spirituality, men lost their nature, or soul. As soon as you wish to be natural, you become common. The furs with which Mossack's women surround themselves have multiple meanings, but the first of these meanings is that they are cold in a glacial environment. Wrapped in furs, Mossack's heroines are constantly sneezing. The interpretation of furs as a paternal image is singularly baseless. Furs are first a directly maternal symbol, implying the folding of the law into the feminine principle, mater natura, threatened by the ambition of her sons. Bears are the animal of Artemis. The female bear in furs is the mother. The fur is a maternal trophy. Especially since the law of nature becomes terrifying in its withdrawal. Furs are the fur of the despotic and devouring mother, establishing a gynocratic order. Mossack dreams that his lover becomes a bear, strangling him and tearing him apart. The feminine, chthonic, and lunar deities, the great female hunters, the powerful Amazons, the reigning courtesans, all reflect the rigor of this law of nature that is identical to the maternal principle. In Legacy of Cain, the oldest son, a farmer and the mother's favorite, should be understood as a maternal image of the mother herself, who goes so far as to commit a crime to break the spiritual alliance of the father with the other son, with the shepherd. Yet the final triumph of the paternal, virile, or glacial principle represents the repression of the anima, the advent of a new law, the institution of a world where spiritual alliances prevail over the maternal bond of blood. Roman world, then Christian, where Venus no longer has a place. Venus, in this abstract north, in this icy Christian world, has to creep into huge black furs, so as not to catch cold. Stay among your northern fogs and Christian incense. Let us pagans remain under the debris, beneath the lava. You do not require gods. We are chilled in your world. Passionate, simplified, and romanced, we can recognize the famous theses of Bakofen on the three states of humanity here. Primitive heterism, gynocracy, and patriarchy. Bakofen's influence is undeniable and explains Mossack's ambition to write a natural history of humanity. However, the regressive fantasy through which Mossack dreams of using the patriarchy itself to restore the gynocracy and the gynocracy to restore primitive communism is properly masochistic. The one who unearths the anima would be able to turn the patriarchal structures to her advantage and rediscover the power of the devouring mother. In The Black Tsarina, Mossack tells the story of a female prisoner of the Tsar in the year 900. She hunts bear and takes the trophy of its fur. She organizes a regiment of Amazons. She kills the boyars and has the Tsar decapitated by a black woman. A man of the commune, a communist, seems to be the distant goal of her actions. In Sabbatai Zweig, a messiah has a third marriage with a woman who refuses him. The sultan wants the marriage to be consummated. The woman whips her husband, crowns him with thorns, consummates the marriage, and says to him, "I made you a man. You are not the messiah." Again in Mossack, the true man emerges from the rigors of the restored gynocracy, just as the powerful woman and her resaturation emerge from the structures of a diverted patriarchy. In the regressive fantasy, domestic relations, conjugal relations, contractual relations themselves shift in favor of the terrifying woman or the devouring mother. It then becomes highly doubtful that the image of the father has the role ascribed to it in masochism by Freud. Freudian psychoanalysis suffers from a general inflation of the father. In the particular case of masochism, we witness a stunning gymnastic display to explain how the image of the father is first internalized in the superego, then re-externalized in the image of a woman. Everything takes place as if Freudian interpretations often only reach the most superficial and most individualized levels of the unconscious. They do not go into the deep dimensions where the image of the mother rules of its own accord, owing nothing to the influence of the father. The same is true of the unity of sadism and masochism. Based on the role of the father, they dissipate beyond the first layers of the unconscious. That there are very different layers of the unconscious, of unequal origin and value, eliciting regressions that differ in nature, with relationships of opposition, compensation, and reorganization between each other. This principle was dear to Jung, but not recognized by Freud, because he reduced the unconscious to the simple fact of desiring. It so happens that we witness alliances of consciousness with the superficial layers of the unconscious that are to hold at bay the deeper unconscious that surrounds us with the bond of blood. There are also things in the unconscious that are only appearances. Freud senses it, however, when he discovers the existence of an unconscious of identification beyond the properly objectal unconscious. This image, which dominates in the unconscious from the point of view of objectal relations, can lose all value or mean something else in the deeper regions. Many neurotics seem fixated on the father, but are disturbed and crushed by a mother image that is all the more powerful in that it is not invested in the superficial unconscious. As a general rule, the dominant characters change depending on the level of analysis one reaches. Beware of those for whom analysis reveals in the first approximation the image of an inactive, faded, or even depreciated mother. In masochism, it is probable that the figure of the father is only apparently invasive, a simple means for a deeper end, a simple stage in a more distant regression, where the paternal determinations can be seen to turn in favor of the mother. We asked, why does masochism project the contract into its relationship with a dominant woman? Because, more profoundly, application of the paternal law is thereby placed in the hands of the woman or the mother. Masochism expects the following from this transfer: that the law gives precisely that pleasure it was supposed to deny. The pleasure that the paternal law forbids, it will be tasted through the law as soon as the law, in its full rigor, is applied to the masochist by the woman. Behind the first appearances, we discover a real characteristic of the masochist. In fact, his extreme submission means that he mocks the father and the paternal law. Reich, spelled R-E-I-K, wrote one of the best books on masochism because he started out from the formal characteristics to determine its essence. He identified four characteristics: the primordial importance of fantasy as indispensable preliminary to the masochist exercise, the suspensive factor, where the final pleasure is pushed back to the maximum, replaced by a weight that controls and dissolves the anxiety, the demonstrative trait, specifically masochist reverse exhibition, the factor of provocation, where the masochist forces another person to force him. It is strange that Reich did not take the contract into account. Nevertheless, his study of the preceding factors already led him to conclude that the masochist does not have a weak and submissive personality dreaming of self-annihilation. Challenge, vengeance, sarcasm, sabotage, and derision seem to him to be constitutive traits of masochism. The masochist uses the law of the father to obtain precisely the pleasure that it forbids. We have several examples of diverting the law through feigned or exaggerated submission. For example, the law that prohibits the child from smoking can be circumvented in hidden and cursed places, where it is hard to apply. However, the child can act as if the law applied by ordering him or her to smoke in these places and nowhere else. More generally, there are two ways to interpret the operation through which the law separates us from a pleasure. Either we think that it rejects and dismisses it uniformly, such that we would only achieve pleasure through a destruction of the law, sadism. Or we think that the law took pleasure into itself, kept it for itself. It is therefore by espousing the law, by submitting ourselves scrupulously to the law and its consequences, that we taste the pleasure that it forbids. The masochist goes even further. The execution of the punishment comes first and introduces us to the forbidden pleasure. Reversal in time indicates a reversal of content. The you should not do this. A demonstration of the absurdity of punishment is obtained by showing that this punishment for a forbidden pleasure produces precisely the same pleasure. The same law that forbids achievement of a desire on the penalty of substantial punishment is now a law that puts punishment first and orders me as a result to satisfy the desire. There is a form of specifically masochist humor here. Reich's thesis has the advantage of abandoning the explanation of masochism as the desire to be punished. Of course, the desire to be punished comes into play, but it is impossible to confuse the satisfaction of this desire with the sexual pleasure experienced by the masochist. The masochist, according to Reich, is someone who can only experience pleasure after the punishment. It does not mean that he or she finds the pleasure in the punishment, perhaps a secondary pleasure. It only means that the punishment serves as the necessary condition for primary sexual pleasure. Far from explaining masochism, the desire to be punished presupposes it and itself only refers to a derivative benefit. Reich is less convincing, however, when he tries to explain how and why punishment came to serve as a condition in this way. He thinks that its dynamic role is to reduce anxiety or to control it. This indirect reference to the feeling of guilt leads us nowhere. No matter what the real difference with the theory of the desire to be punished, this approach proposes a functional explanation that does not take into account the topical characteristics of masochism. The question remains, how, under what topical circumstances, does punishment fulfill the function of reducing anxiety? Masochist pleasure becomes a condition of sexual pleasures, not because it reduces anxiety, but because it attributes to the mother the task of chastising a wrongdoing committed toward the father. Or, if you prefer, the punishment effectively reduces anxiety through this displacement. Reich's error seems to be an insistence on the apparent role of the father and not evaluating the importance of projection on the woman or regression to the mother. As such, he misses the true nature of masochist derision. The father is ridiculed. The paternal law is ridiculed thanks to the projection of the contract to the extent that a regression occurs towards the mother and where the application of the paternal law appears symbolically placed in the hands of the woman. At first glance, however, it is not clear what is soothing in this displacement. There is no reason to count in general on greater indulgence from the devouring mother. However, we have to take into consideration that the paternal law as such forbids incest with the mother. As Jung showed, incest signifies a second birth, in other words, a heroic birth, a parthenogenesis, entering a maternal breast a second time to be born again or to undergo a rebirth. The father forbids incest not because a woman would be taken away from him, but because the second birth takes place without him. It is clear that the mother does not have the same reasons to prohibit incest or to punish the desire for it. The maternal law requires the son to abandon all attributes of the father, but it requires it as a condition of incest and its success. For that reason, the mother is not only devouring in that her image is repressed, but in herself and through herself. She imposes terrifying trials on the son for him to be reborn, a man, though herself alone. Thus, the castration of Attis on Osiris, being swallowed by a dragon whale or a hungry fish, snake bites, hanging from the maternal tree, all of these symbols of return to the mother signify the need to sacrifice the genital sexuality inherited from the father to obtain the rebirth that would grant us a new and independent virility. Hercules is made effeminate by Omphale. Osiris couples with Isis, but as a shade. Incest is always imagined as a return to pregenital sexuality. We see that on one point, castration, the maternal law and the paternal law present a strange coincidence. However, that which from the father's perspective is a threat preventing incest or a punishment penalizing it is on the contrary, from the mother's perspective, a condition that makes it possible and ensures its success. The regression to the mother therefore explains how the paternal law is inverted in time and in content. When the masochist, due to his coincidence, projects the application of paternal law and the execution of punishment on the image of the mother, there are two results. The maternal law is reinforced and as if revived because it converts all the weapons of the father to its benefit. The paternal law is ridiculed because it leads precisely to giving us the same pleasure that it was supposed to forbid us. Freud distinguished between three types of increasingly deeper masochism. Oral masochism, corresponding to the desire to be punished. Feminine masochism, corresponding to the passive attitude and even pregenital satisfaction. Erogenous masochism, corresponding to the association of pain and sexual pleasure. However, the desire to be punished in masochism is inseparable from an attempt to divert paternal authority. This attempt, inseparable from the transfer to the mother that gives us a pregenital, incestuous pleasure, this pleasure itself, inseparable from an ordeal or a painful sacrifice as condition of the success of incest, in other words, rebirth. The masochist fantasy goes back from the image of the father to that of the mother, and from the image to the man of the community, it also includes the theme of the two mothers that symbolize the double birth. The image of mother, the regression to this image, is constitutive of masochism and form its unity. On the condition of interpreting this original image, as Jung did, as an archetype of the deep layers of the unconscious. The problem of masochism was singularly complicated because some began by taking from the woman some characteristics that belong to the maternal image, to be more surprised that she received them from the outside, here and elsewhere, by making the image something composite, its leading and comprehensive power was removed. When Freud discovered a primary masochism, he helped analysis make major progress by refusing to derive masochism from sadism. It is true that the reverse derivation is no more convincing. Masochists and sadists have no more chance of coming together in the same individual than they do of meeting outside, contrary to what the joke would have us believe. Moreover, Freud's explanation of primary masochism by the death instinct again shows that he did not believe in symbols or images as such. A general tendency of Freudism dispels images, making them something composite that refers on one hand to real events and on the other to desires or instincts that cannot be reduced, that are never symbolizing for themselves. According to Freud, therefore, the sexual is never symbol. And in the death instinct, it is a question of a real death and an irreducible instinct that is the return to matter. Nevertheless, Freud recognized that the only nature of instinct consists in regression, and the only difference between instincts, for example, of life and death, in the term of regression. He failed to grasp the role of original images. They cannot be explained by anything other than themselves. On the contrary, they are both the term of regressions and the principle of interpretation of events themselves. Symbols do not allow themselves to be reduced or composed. On the contrary, they are the ultimate rule for the composition of desires, and the object they form, the only reducible facts of the unconscious. The irreducible fact of the unconscious is the symbol itself, and not a symbolized end. In truth, everything is a symbol in the unconscious. Sexuality, death, no less than the rest. Death should be understood as a symbolic death, and the return to matter as a return to symbolic death. Instincts are only internal perceptions of original images, apprehended where they are, in the diverse layers of the unconscious. Masochism is the perception of the maternal image, or the devouring mother. It takes the detours and the path necessary to perceive it where it is. It is important that this path is not lost. There always exists a truth of neuroses or of disorders as such. The problem of treatment is not to dissolve symbols to substitute a just appreciation of reality for them, on the contrary, to the benefit from what is surreal in them to give the neglected elements of our personality the development for which they ask. Every neurosis has two faces. In masochism, the regression to the mother is like the pathological protest of a part of ourselves crushed by law, but also the possibility of compensatory or normative progression of this same part, as perceived in the masochist fantasy of rebirth. It is up to treatment here and elsewhere to prove the patient right, in conformance with the truth of his or her disorder. In other words, to actualize the possibilities of the neurosis by reintegrating them into the personality as a whole. Thank you.